Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I'm Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type. But if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Hey, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. Looking forward to a good net tonight, and I have a new microphone. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. I'm looking forward to not having you have any dropouts anymore and those little beeps that happened during the dropouts, so that's great. And welcome back to the technical net. You were busy with other things last month. I'm glad to have you back. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If there's anyone out there with any questions or topics for discussions or comments, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign. Well, as per usual, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net is always a little slow on starting up, but you know, once it starts up, it persists. I don't really have any prepared monologues for tonight. Keep in mind that the next time that we'll be meeting together will be after the field day. So I hope everyone is ready and prepared for field day coming up soon. Anyway, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or topics for discussions or comments, feel free to hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Victor to Oscar. Monica in Manhattan.
Very good, Monica. I hear you nice and clear. Anyone else want to put their name down? Okay, perhaps later on we'll get a little bit more activity with other people. Monica, do you have any questions or topic for discussions or comments tonight?
I run about a 35-foot wire outside my window. I'm on a 5-foot, about on the fifth floor of an apartment house in Manhattan, typical, you know, brick apartment house that we see all over the city. And I'm facing east, but yet I get seem to get a lot of propagation to the west, like through the building. And I was just wondering, do you guys think that that's bouncing off of other buildings, or is it just going through? And it's a brick you know, veneer building, and I'm just, you know, just kind of curious as to what you might think.
Well, you know, it could be a little bit of both. It doesn't necessarily need to be one or the other. I know people who used to operate UHF, VHF by bouncing off water towers. So it certainly is possible that some of your HF is bouncing off some other structure and going in the right direction for your traffic. Also, depending upon which portion of the HF band, some of it can go through buildings. It depends on its how much metal is in it, you know, if it's a Faraday cage construction or if it's a sieve. So, you know, I would say, unfortunately, that it's probably both things going on simultaneously to one degree or another. I know it sounds like I'm fudging the answer, but that's the way I perceive it with the little facts that I have available.
I just wanted to get another viewpoint, and I appreciated Kilo Victor to Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you would tend to think that things work the way the books always say. And sometimes luck is on your side. And so whether it's some nice big reflective structure that's bouncing your signals back from the other side, or just enough gets leaky through your brick house, you know, whatever works. There used to be a guy on the Limark technical net who had an antenna that basically was just lying on the ground that defied most people's explanation of how it was effective, and yet for him it was effective. So I never question good luck.
Appreciate the feedback.
You're welcome, Monica, anytime. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone else out there has any topics for discussion or comments or questions, please feel free. Hit that push to talk.
Roy, this is W2BZ. May I ask a question?
Certainly, Rich. You're free to ask a question.
Okay, Echolink's a little slow. As you know, I buy these little kits from either Alibaba, AliExpress, or from eBay just to practice my soldering skills. You know, like digital clocks and a Morse code keyer and a bunch of others. Well, I just finished today a power supply that is a zero to 30 volt power supply. The inputs are confusing me because on one side of the board there is a terminal with three pins and that says 24V AC. To me that means 24 volts AC. On the other side of the board is another header, two pins, that just says out. So I suppose that you hook up whatever electricity you're going to hook up, the one that says 24 AC volts, and there are also two pots on it, so you could regulate, you know, how much power this thing is creating. The thing is, why does it say 24 volt VAC? Because I know this is an elementary question, but I'd be hooking up 110 volts to the input of this power supply, not 24 volts, so I'm a little confused.
Well, you're not the only one who's confused. That makes no sense to me whatsoever on so many interesting levels. Number one, if you are plugging in the primary of a power supply transformer, I don't understand why it would need to be split in the middle. The split in the middle makes perfect sense if it's the output to a bridge rectifier as part of a power supply. You have the 120 volts input to two wires. It goes to a step down transformer of 24 volts with a center tap. You configure it with a full wave bridge, so you rectify it entirely. You put it through a filter capacitor, and you have some form of voltage regulation somewhere along the line to adjust the voltage down from the peak that it's available to the acceptable numbers with a controller. It sounds as though you have the transformer upside down. It sounds like the output is the input, and the 24 volt with the center tap is the output of the step down power transformer, if I had to guess, because otherwise it doesn't quite make any sense to me.
Doesn't make any sense to me either, but on the circuit board, you know, the two terminal connector is labeled out, and the three terminal connector on the other side of the board labeled 24 VAC. Why does the one labeled 24 VAC, whatever that is, need three pins rather than just two pins if you're feeding in AC to that side and DC coming out the other side? I don't understand what the third pin is on the header.
Okay, first things first, transformers will not rectify. Transformers only transform from one voltage alternating current to another voltage alternating current. You then need to put it through some form of rectification and some filtration and some voltage regulation. Again, my best guess is Chinglish strikes again that they've mislabeled the diagram. If they gave you at least the schematic, it should be rather simple to figure out what the center tap is doing. If the center tap is connected to the output to the rectifier circuit, then you know that they've mislabeled. Of course, if they haven't given you a schematic, that's a terrible thing. They should at least give you a schematic for this thing. So is there a schematic, number one? And if there is a schematic, where is that center tapped transformer situated in the schematic?
Nope, no schematic with this kit. Usually ones this involved do come with a schematic, but nothing with this. In fact, I was very confused about one of the diodes that they supplied. It looked like they left out one diode, but it was a different type of diode. And so they had five diodes, all the same, and then a sixth diode, but a whole different type of diode. I sent you the picture this afternoon of the circuit board. You could readily see the two blue input and output headers. I don't know. Maybe it's something that that is not to be known. But it is a power supply. It's a 0 to 30 volt power supply. But I don't know how to hook up the power to it or read what's coming out the other end either. So that's the only thing to do is to hook up 120 volts to one side of it and see what smokes and what caps pop. And if that happens, then I know I've done it wrong. But usually they don't mislabel that heavily. They don't mislabel that heavily. Don't know, Roy. If I don't know if you could pull up the picture that I emailed you, but if you can't tell from that, then no use trying.
Yeah, I'm trying to take a look at it. It's kind of difficult to all do these things simultaneously, and some of it is hidden. It's a 0 to 30 volt power supply unit, so that makes sense to me. So far, so good. But then I don't really even, for some strange reason, see the whole. Let me see if I can extend this. I really didn't have it set up to do this before the net. So trying to figure out bits and pieces of it. And I don't know. I mean, theoretically, you would think you would want a power supply that was able to be plugged into 120 volts utility. I don't understand the purpose of a power supply that you need a power supply for.
Yeah, that's the way it looks, doesn't it? It looks like you have to have regulated 24 volts AC going into this thing to get, well, I don't know. Well, I don't know if you can get 30 volts if you put in 24 volts. I guess you can. But, yep, that's what it's labeled, 24 volts AC. Don't know. Anyway, don't rack your brain if it's one of those Chinese tricks they're pulling on us. Anyway, all the solder, I did a great job in soldering. I am getting better in soldering and all the kits that I solder, except the SMD. I tried one resistor on an SMD circuit board, and I just gave up, and I threw the whole circuit board and all the rest of the components in the garbage because I don't want to be frustrated like that. I couldn't hold the resistor down with the tweezers. I couldn't, I guess you have to do that with flux, with solder flux. And I don't have the stuff that comes in a hypodermic needle that you squeeze onto the circuit board and then place the different components. So, but regular components, I'm pretty good now at soldering. And no overlapping, no bridges or anything like that. And I find it very relaxing to do it. But I would like at the end of it to at least get a reading coming out of this thing into an ohm meter that it's working. But it just doesn't make any sense. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I'm taking a look at this picture, and for the life of me, maybe it's me, I don't see a transformer anyplace. I see a massive filter capacitor, I see some ICs, I see what looks like a regulator or a field effects transistor, probably a regulator. Is there actually a transformer on this? Because the way it looks to me is it's not a voltage. It simply rectifies 24 volts of AC power to anywhere from 0 to 30 volts. So it's like the power supply past the transformer itself. So you have a transformer someplace else that's 120 volts input and 24 volts output that goes into that connection, and the rest of this is a regulation and rectifying and smoothing board. It doesn't step down the 120 volts of power. So if you plugged in your 120 volts of power to where it says 24, you'd probably blow a lot of those ICs and other discrete components.
You know, I'm sort of ashamed of myself, but this is how we learn, right? You know me. I ask a million questions about a million things, and I assumed that it was a power supply and a voltage regulator. What you're saying makes total sense now. It's just a voltage regulator. It has nothing to do with transforming any AC to DC. It's just taking DC and outputting DC. That sound right, Roy?
Well, judging from what it looks like, it's also rectifying. So what it seems to be is kind of like, here you are, here's a PC board. Just supply your own step-down transformer that will supply you with 24 volts of alternating current at the input of this board, and the output will be DC, anywhere from 0 to 30 volts, according to how you adjust the controls. So the input is step down AC, and the output is 0 to 30 volts DC. So the only thing missing in this would be the step down transformer.
Bravo 2, Whiskey, Oscar, November.
Yes. What would you like to say? Yes, Whiskey, Oscar, November. I was not unable to hear your prefix. What would you like to say, sir?
Kilo Bravo 2, Whiskey Oscar November. Just wanted to check in there. I meant to check in last night with the regular net, but I missed it, so I said, let me check in and give your net a turn there. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you for checking in. I appreciate it. I hope you have a question or a topic or a comment for tonight, but I appreciate you checking in.
No topic for tonight, Roy, but good hearing your voice. Over.
Well, Selvin, it's always a pleasure hearing you. It's been too long, so I hope to hear you a lot more times here on the Technical Net in future TechNets.
Affirmative. I'm back in town for a little while, so I'll check in a little more often. Over.
Okay, very good. Like I said, always a pleasure. I wonder if you're going to be joining the club for a field day in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. I had a talk with Max a couple of days ago, and I'll definitely stop by for field day. Over.
Okay, very good. Pleasure to talk to you. Getting back to the previous question, comment, Rich, so I think this was kind of meant for someone who, you know, could figure out, get a 24-volt step-down transformer and plug it into the electronics and put it in a case or something and have a nice little regulated power supply. So all you need is that extra transformer and you're good to go.
Now, why, you know, if you look on the circuit board, there are two pots that are manually adjustable. I don't know why there are two. If you're adjusting it from 0 to 30 volts, why do you need two pots? That's number one. Number two, what would be the purpose of this board? If I could give it 24 volts, what would be the purpose of this board that a power supply couldn't handle, an all-in-one power supply, that rectifies and it reduces voltages, you know, like for a computer. Why the two adjustable pots, and if someone could supply 24 volts, what is this thing used for?
Well, you know, without proper documentation, I couldn't definitively tell you, but common sense would indicate that most likely one of those knobs adjusts the voltage from 0 to 30 volts, and the other one probably limits the output current. I can't tell you exactly from what amps to what amps. In some cases, you might require a flexible regulated power supply. At some points, you might need 5 volts. At other times, you might need 12 volts. Other times, you might need 24 volts. So, and also, sometimes it's nice to limit the amount of output current so that if there's a short or it draws too much too quickly, the thing doesn't burn out before you tweak the settings of such things. So that would be my guess, that it would not take the place of a regulated power supply capable of adjusting the voltage and the current. It's simply one half of that device itself, so that if you wanted to, you could solder the regulation and rectifying board that you have, get yourself a 24-volt to 120-volt transformer, get yourself a little box to put it all in, and you'll have a regulated power supply for different electronic kits and experiments and such that require different voltages and different current limitations. That would be my guess. It's a shame it doesn't come with proper documentation, though.
Yeah, usually a board of this, a board this involved comes with a parts list, even. This came with nothing, just the parts and the circuit board. And that was it. But I guess it's beyond my pay grade to know why somebody would need to sit there with two pots and regulate the output able to vary the output for different situations. I don't know, maybe running Arduinos or something. I have no idea, beyond my pay grade. Well, I spent a good, peaceful hour and a half soldering this together. Looks like all the solders are fine, so I'm done with it. I don't need to, you know, for my big $5 or whatever it was, I don't really need to be able to use it. Thanks, Roy.
Welcome, Rich. You know, some people do use things like this. It depends upon if you experiment. You know, there are these little breadboards that you can plug in components, and it depends what kind of devices, what kind of instrumentation that you're using. Some of them are TTL logic, some of them CMOS. Some things are designed to run on 5 volts. Others are designed to run on a little bit more. So it's a nice additional capability of a power supply to be able to adjust to different voltages for different purposes. Otherwise, you'd have to have, you know, a 5-volt power supply for one thing, and a 9-volt for another, and a 12-volt for another. So there is a value in this. Again, it would probably be nicer if they explained it to you, but I guess, you know, these were kind of, I guess, sold pretty much for practice soldering as opposed to any kind of practical use. So they were able to not bother getting the Chinese translated into English.
I have a power supply that's a variable power supply. It's looks like, you know, the kind of wall wart you get with a computer, a laptop. And it's variable, so that is easy to figure out. You put 120 in, you get out anywhere from 0 to 12 volts. So that's a variable power supply. That's not this. I guess the variable one that I have, you're saying, has both the step down and this. I think that's what you're saying, right?
In a word, yes. What you probably have is a switching power supply in which it takes the 60 cycle input and it speeds it up to kilocycles, and then it runs it through a much more smaller but efficient transformer to step it down to a certain voltage. And then it takes the voltage and does all the things that your board that you sent me a picture of does. This is not a switching power supply. It's a regular linear power supply because you're using a bigger, heavier step-down transformer to feed the AC into this device. So this would be the voltage and current regulation and rectification of a linear amplifier without the proper step-down transformer, whereas your variable thing for the computer is probably a complete switching power supply, which includes a high-frequency oscillator and a much more efficient, smaller step-down transformer.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to Google not this, because I've Googled it and there's no schematics or anything. I'm just going to Google voltage regulators, maybe 0 to 30 volt voltage regulators, and see how they're used. I guess that's the way we learn. Anyway, Roy, thanks so much. I know this isn't my club, but since nobody was checking in, thought I'd ask you this this question. Somebody learned something from it anyway. I did. I really did. All right, because everything you say makes sense. All right. Thank you. Back to you, Roy.
CV.
Yes, Monica, what would you like to say?
Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor, not Monica, it's William checking in.
Okay, William, you consider yourself checked in. Also, I think I heard Monica. So, Monica, if you're out there and you you dropped your call sign, I think, if you respond, please.
AB2O, Monica. No, I was just listening, but I'm here if anybody needs to talk to me.
Okay, very good. I just didn't want to leave you out. William, how are you doing tonight? Do you have any questions or comments for tonight?
Yeah, I got a good one for you, but I don't think you're going to help me any better than Apple support. I was over 30, I don't know, long time in Apple support, which is why I'm 30 minutes late for the net.
Well, I am not an Apple guy, certainly not Genius Bar, but if you want to give it a try, give it a try.
The question is, I heard that I couldn't get my iPhotos back properly, so I tried downloading it. It all comes in with today's date. And I called them and I said, how do I make it not come in with today's date? And they went through this whole thing with me and it still did it. So now they said I should download the whole iPhoto media ball onto a different computer altogether and then do an export, and that might work. But they had no consolation that it would work.
Okay, I'm not 100% sure. Is the date being imprinted on the visible image, and you don't want that stamping to take place? Is that what you're having a problem with?
It's the date of the file was created. Typically, you know, it used to be with Apple, I could download files and get the date it was created, and I was able to sort out my archive by date, you know, because I would just take the file, sort by date, and then make month folders and stick stuff in, boom, boom, boom. But now that doesn't work, because if I try to download from iCloud, what happens is it just comes in and on today's date. So I'm thinking I wanted to try a full backup of everything on iCloud and start over, because I think it's a big mess. But I can't do that.
Okay, so what's going on, as far as I can figure, is it's giving you today's date. If you download it, instead of preserving its date of creation, it's giving you its date of last modification. If you look in the file directory, sometimes there's more than one date available, again, because there are distinctly two types of dates for files, when it was created and when it was last modified. And some downloading and transferring software can screw that up. So it's possible that it's a screw-up at Apple's end, that they're resetting the creation date with the date that you downloaded and screwing up your timeline, if you will. If it's at all possible to download it using any other method, just to see if you can kind of get around that software situation. I'm sort of surprised that they don't either have a solution, or they can't tell you what's going on. It sounds like they're confused as well.
I had to get through first level support, and then I stumped the band on second level support, and she said there was no third level support. And so I said, really? There's got to be. I mean, I'm not an enterprise customer, but I know there's third level support here. But I wasn't able to get there. I don't have those keys.
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem is, I guess you need to supply them with the magic incantation or something. Most likely, if you just keep banging away, you'll probably end up talking to someone who actually knows something about the subject. You know, I tried that. Sometimes you succeed, sometimes you fail. When I had a question about an MFJ product, and I called their technical support line, one guy just made up answers, And so I tried it a different time, and I caught a different tech. And he sounded like he knew more than the first guy, but strangely enough, he told me that he thought it best for him not to give me any suggestions in case he got it wrong and it screwed up my radio, and he didn't want to be responsible for that. But I mean, if you can't figure it out yourself, and a lot of these things people can't, I would try climbing the mountain a different time. There are so many different people who answer the technical support lines, and there's got to be at least a few by random error who actually know what they're talking about.
I'm really relieved to speak to somebody that could actually speak a good quality English and sounded like they might have been in California. But it's hard to tell, and I've been through a lot of tech support phone calls, so I know what you're talking about, and I think that's a good suggestion. But I'm going to give this a try. She's got me a number to jump through to second-level support for the second time. So I don't know how many times I have to do this to ring their bell, but I'm trying to back up my computers and straighten out my life, and it's just like everything is a big mess, and I don't know how to fix it.
Yeah, I feel your pain, William. Computers, you know, I have this ongoing phrase I say, love them, hate them, you know, you can't live with them, you can't live without them these days. But sometimes they are a massive challenge to figure out how to get them to do what you want them to do. So, you know, along with contacting these people again, and it'll be different people, so you'll have a slightly better chance, I would Google it. I would go to forums. Go to Reddit. The only thing that could happen is some snarky, Gen Xer or such could kind of say something nasty to you. But you might get help there. If you can find any other interface for downloading it other than iClouds, I would investigate that as well. Because, again, it might be a foible with your interaction with iClouds that might be causing it.
The only other option, which I can't do, is like get a PC and then put an iCloud client on the PC and then try that. But I don't think there's any third party that can download stuff out of iCloud. That's something to Google. I don't know. No, you give me something to do tomorrow anyway. Take care.
NBB with a comment.
Yes, Bob. I'll turn to you in one second. I just wanted to mention to William that if you have any hard copy of it on an iPad, or some device, iPhone, it is possible to plug in plug in your Lightning to your computer and download it directly from the memory in those devices. So that might be a way to kind of short circuit iCloud, because iCloud is keeping a copy of it in the clouds, but for the most part, many of our Apple devices have a hard copy that's in recording in our devices, and there's ways to access that. So you might investigate that. But Bob, what's your idea?
82NBB here. William, I was just, in case you don't already know about it, there's another forum that's often good. I mean, you get a mixture of smart and not so smart people. But tell me to get some good stuff at MacRumors.com, in case you don't already know about that. All sorts of topics. There's probably what about iCloud, all these categories. So you can check that out. Just call MacRumors.com, or just type MacRumors, you'll find it. Back to Ned.
I think that's probably a good idea, and I like your idea, Roy, too, because I have another program that does it for music, but I don't know that it'll get into iCloud. We'll see. I couldn't get into iCloud last time I tried this program, and now I got a new phone, and so I'm trying everything on the new phone. So I'm not sure that's going to work. But, Bob, I think your suggestion is also pretty good. So I'm going to think about how to do that, too. I think I'd have to actually post something there as a big, big fat complaint about how Apple won't let me do XYZ. and then everybody will weigh in on it. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, like any forum, it's a big forum with tons of archives. I would search the archives before I posted anything. Like, I do that in general. You might find someone did the exact same or very close problem. I already got a whole thread that would answer, give you a lot of ideas. You might not even have to post anything, but do a search, or there are all these categories. I don't even know what they are. I've used this forum off and often for years on my Shop for a Mac or different issues. Yeah, so that's my suggestion. Back to that.
I really like Mac Rumors. Whenever, you know, I search for something and Mac Rumors comes up, usually the answer is okay. I have to, like, modify a lot of times for different operating systems, but they seem to know what they're talking about, and they do maintain a good archive that goes back pretty far. So with me, I've got computers that go back to 9.1, and so I have lots of issues trying to figure out how to run each computer every time I light it up. But anyway, this time I'm trying to help my wife out with her photo app and get her photos off of iCloud in a way she can deal with them, because now she's upset with everything and I don't know how to do it. And I tried it on mine and it doesn't work. So it's now a new calling, unfortunately.
Yes, you said is it photos you're trying to do? I think I heard that right. iPhoto, is it trying to do some kind of transfer or something?
Yeah, somehow they don't export with the right date, the right creation date. So it didn't come out of Photos properly, and I tried to bring it from iCloud. Doesn't come from iCloud properly. So everything is kind of screwed up, and I don't know if it's all the computers I have around the house or whatever. So I'm going to keep doing research. It's probably going to take me a couple of weeks, and I might get to the end of it, and I might not. It's up in the air at this point.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah. I bet. Well, if that's happening to you, it's... Well, you don't need me to tell you that. It could happen to some other people that posted. Of course, you can always make your own post as well. Good luck with that, William. Back to net.
That good luck charm you gave me and tied onto my net, onto my fishing hook, and cast it wide. Anyway, back to net control, Roy.
Very good. William, Google is your friend. All I did was type, and I'll say it very slowly so you write it down or something. I just typed into Google, download iCloud files without change in date. And there's a whole bunch of things. One says no original date and time when downloading photos, archive or make copies of information you store in iCloud. iCloud Drive does not automatically download files, transfer files from iCloud to OneDrive without losing date. Date changes when moving iCloud photos to external hard drive, and on and on and on. So my suggestion before you do any of the previous ones is do a Google search, see if there's someone responding that sounds like he understands what's going on, and the answer is not try to turn the machine off and on again, and give it a try. But, you know, Google is your friend.
I appreciate that. I'm going to give it a shot, and I'll report back to you in 2 weeks. How it goes. But my experience with this is there's a lot of those good titles up there, and it says, me too, I have the same problem. And then you say, what's the answer? And there's no answer. So I'll try that. Give me the exact search language you used again, because sometimes I know that if I put in a different string of words, I get different garbage back. So I'm going to write it down better this time. I scribbled it.
Yeah, sure, no problem. You know, these Google has a very low signal to noise ratio, unfortunately. But if you get lucky, once in a while, someone actually answers. So the way that I phrased it was, download iCloud files without change in date. But you know, you could probably move the words around a little bit, and you'll still get roughly the same type of list of comments. I don't think you're alone here. I think there are other people. Whether there are other people who solved your problem or solved their problem or it just kind of glitched, and when they tried it again, it just spontaneously worked, and so they patted themselves on the back. I can't tell you. But those were the lines. Download iCloud files without change in date. Okay?
I got that 10-4 loud and clear. Okay. Anyway, thanks a lot for my tech question. That's what was driving me crazy all night tonight. And maybe I'll have some fun tomorrow. But tomorrow I'm going to go out on the picnic and see my friends at the Science Society of Broadcast Engineers out in their AM tower. They have an AM HD tower. So anyway, won't be able to do it tomorrow, but maybe over the weekend. Anyway, thanks a lot for the tip, and take care. Back to net control.
Okay. Good luck, William, as always. And I look forward to the next TechNet or the one after that. You drop by and tell us how it worked out, because I'm always interested in learning new things. Although, like I said, although I do use iCloud because I have iPads and I have iPhones, I don't have Apple computers. So all my computers run on PCs and Windows and such. Anyway, good luck. Once again, I remain AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if there's any questions or comments or topics, please hit that push to talk.
ZJK.
Yes, unfortunately, the repeater kind of clips the prefix, so I got your suffix, 2ZJK. Could you give me your prefix and your first name?
Delta 2, Zulu, Juliet, Kilo. My name's Lauren. I'm over here in New Jersey in Park Ridge. You know, I'm trying to configure FT8 for my Yaesu 450D. It doesn't have an internal sound card, so everyone's telling me I need an interface sound card, you know, like a Signal Link or an SCU-17. But I'm investigating ways to get around it. I was wondering if anyone has any experience with this.
Okay, Lauren, I go the simple approach. It's a little bit more expensive. You really ultimately, you do need some kind of a sound card. I mean, you could fashion your own sound cards, or you could buy really cheap sound card USB interfaces pull the analog signals into them and get the USB, and you know that'll cost you only about $15. The problem is these things are not shielded in the slightest, and so when I have tried to do that, the RF that just kind of overrides any kind of signal makes these devices useless anywhere near a transmitter. You may get lucky, or you may spend a lot of time and effort building a Faraday cage for an inexpensive digital-to-analog converter, USB type of thing. I don't know if it's really worth the trouble. You know, it's kind of reinventing the wheel. But certainly, if you want to do something like that, because inevitably you're going to be introducing the signal into a computer to do the FT8, so you're going to have to turn it from an audio analog signal to a digital. So you're going to need a DAC. So you either build your own DAC from chips, or you buy a really cheap one from Amazon that's not shielded against RF. Or you buy something that's shielded completely against RF, has all kinds of nice controls, and help pages if you have any problems with it.
About 10 hours of playing around with this already, and I've gotten, you know, it's been fruitless. I've gotten nowhere. There are so many videos on YouTube and information for people who do have rigs, like the Yaesu 450 and the Yaesu 991, and they say purchase the 6-pin data connector and plug it into the stereo, the headphone jack on your PC. So I go from the back of the rig with the data and into the PC. And I could go ahead and receive on FT8, but it doesn't want to transmit out. I can't get the rig to transmit. I'm close, but no cigar, so to speak.
Okay, I mean it's a little on the dangerous side to have unprotected inputs and outputs. It increases the risk of overpowering the circuits so that may or may not be the levels that you're giving it? Because what you're doing is you're pouring your computer analog into your radio's analog and using the sound card in your computer. So that could possibly wreak havoc. Again, if these are all kind of old, ancient models and you're more curious than anything else, then so be it. But I guess theoretically you could just direct connect these things, but I certainly wouldn't suggest it to anyone who cares about their computer. It just, I don't know, it's too easy for something to go terribly, terribly wrong.
I reduce the sound levels. I get to the sound controls and you reduce the sound levels coming in and out. You knock them down, and then you also reduce the power that you're running on the rig. And then on, of course, FT8, you could reduce the volume going in and out. So there are some safety measures you could take place, or you could put in place to help, mitigate that. It's just that, it's something so simple, but it's yet very difficult because of the rig. It's just not, configured for FT8. So a signal link is probably $170. An SCU, I don't know, what is it, $220? So, it's just, FT8's cool, but I'm just trying to do it without spending a ton of money.
Yeah, I understand. I'm a big fan of signal links. I think I have three of them sitting around doing different things. And the benefit is that although there are adjustments for different models, ultimately you could change something designed for one radio to another. So, if situations change and you need something like a signal link for another radio, it's not massive surgery to modify it to work with another one. But yeah, I understand. And again, you may want to try the cheapy $15 Amazon USB audio converter. Maybe you'd have better luck than I have had with them.
One you plug into the USB on the computer and it gives you some audio outputs.
That type. Again, usually they're not terribly well shielded. And it's true, if you keep all of your levels low, you limit your risk significantly, but you never know when your hand will get near a knob and twirl it up. These things have been known to happen, and all of a sudden introduces a big voltage spike. In the case of something like that USB converter, you're safe as far as that's concerned. But I've never gotten it to work well with transmitters, so I'm just giving you a possibility that they've improved over the last few years that I gave up on them.
I have a comment.
Yes, certainly, Monica. Please.
I run FT8 a lot, and I used to run my FT8 with an old Yaesu that didn't have any sound capabilities. And I found, I agree, although it's a little more expensive, the signal link was a lot better, and it was worth, for me it was worth the benefit. It may be different for different people. Right now I run it with the rig with an internal sound card, and that works really well too, but the signal link or a rig blast or something like that just seemed to take a lot of the problems away, and it has a little jumper thing in there, so if you change rigs, you just change the jumpers, and it'll work really well. But you'll be able to decode it because your rig will send the right tones, but you won't be able to generate the right tones necessarily, so that might be an issue, but that's just my 2 cents, Kilo Victor to Oscar.
Yeah, you're you're right.
Well, thanks, Monica. Yeah, I agree with you. I like signal links. Again, I bought three of them. They're well shielded, haven't had any problem with RF, and they have a good degree of isolation, which is important. Lauren mentioned that, you spend anywhere from 150 plus for them. But sometimes you get what you pay for. I realize that amateur radio operators would prefer not to pay for things. But sometimes it's not really productive to reinvent the wheel. There are guys out there who could spend about a half an hour and build their own AC converter and sound card and such, and great for them. It would have taken me a lot longer to debug it and such.
ZJK, what hookup cables do I need coming in and out of SignalLink? Do they give them to you when you buy it, or do I have to purchase those on my own?
Yeah, there are different packs that supply, when you buy it. I think they include the adapter cables.
Well, I have a data connector and a CAT connector on the rig that I could connect to the PC with or the signal link, so I'll have to investigate, take a deeper dive into it.
Yeah, I mean, they're a good bunch of people. There's a lot of documentation available, and they do answer email in a timely manner. So you can peruse the manual, get an idea for what adapters they include and or recommend. I think you could also buy them without any adapter. Then it's just a matter of configuring the jumper settings, which is very simple to do. Take a look, and if you have any questions, ask them. I asked them a bunch of questions at the beginning, and they were very friendly about it.
Roger. Usually when you buy their product, they're going to give you some support to get you up and running. So otherwise, a good word goes a long way, a bad word goes even further. So it's in their interest to support you to keep you relatively happy. So I was just hoping, I didn't have to spend $170 for a signal link. That's all, maybe I can't get around it, I don't know. So far I haven't been able to. But it's nice, FT8, I'm looking at it, I'm seeing all the stations come flying in, it's pretty cool. But unfortunately I haven't been able to transmit, so who knows. But thanks for the input. Monica, thank you very much for jumping in, I appreciate that. And of course, Brooklyn RadioNet, thanks for picking up the call. KD2ZJK.
You're welcome, Lauren. Anytime. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m.
Roger, I appreciate that. Yeah, you have a good repeater here. I live about, 30 miles north of it. But it's worth checking in. You're a class act. You have a good team here.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. We try our best. Once again, everyone else out there, I continue to be Alpha Charlie 2 Gulf Sierra, AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm located in lovely Brooklyn, New York. And this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net on every second and fourth Wednesday of every month. This is the second Wednesday. We'll be back in 2 weeks. But before we leave, if anyone has any other questions or comments for tonight, please feel free to share. Say again. I unfortunately couldn't hear.
This is Kilo Victor 2 Oscar with the comment.
Yes, sure, Monica. Please feel free to comment.
Station that wants to work FT8. Let me just say it's a great mode. I have a compromised antenna, and I'm able to get work really, really well, and it's a lot of fun. And it allows me to get on the air and do things that I might not have be able to do with other modes. So it's really a lot of fun to work, and once you get into it, it's a good thing. So I wish you a lot of luck with that. Kilo Victor 2 Oscar.
Monica, I appreciate that for sure. So this is Lauren over in New Jersey. We spoke last week. So yeah, by all means, I suppose I'm going to have to figure out how to get a signal link and get it going. So I suppose that's next steps. But yeah, I agree. It's stimulating to see all these foreign stations, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 miles away, and you can just, you know, hit them with 5, 10 watts. It's cool. So anyway, thanks again, KD2ZJK.
Yes, indeed. FT8 is a very active mode. If you go to the frequencies, it seems to always be hopping, especially when propagation is just at best only mediocre. You see all these interesting call signs coming across your screen. So it's an interesting technology. It's great if you want to make contacts and you have compromised power limitations or antennas or locations or what have you. It's not great for maintaining a nice long conversation, but if you like a game of tag, it's the best game in town. Joe Taylor, a Nobel laureate, astrophysicist, and another gentleman, I believe, by the name of Frank, brought us. That's FT stands for Frank Taylor. So there's FT4 and there's FT8. So interesting mode. If you've never played around with it, people listening in, give it a try. Take a look at it. If you can't do it yourself, you know, pull out of YouTube and watch someone else do it. It's a fascinating mode. Well, once again, I remain AC2GS. This remains the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any further questions or comments tonight, please hit that push to talk and say your piece. Otherwise, we'll move on to the TechNet puzzle for tonight, which is all tech-based, text-based. There's no pictures, so I'll even read it to you, so you don't even have to go to the page. But if you want to, it's available. You just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com, and it will pop up. So if there's any other questions or comments, please feel free to hit that push to talk.
MVP, I have one. Just shouldn't take too long. We could do it even after the puzzle, but I was just wondering about, I'll just say what it is. I'm just wondering if you know anything more about the IC7100 that you and I both have, about it being discontinued and whether there's a successor model in the works. It looks a little ambiguous about it being discontinued, but these things I pulled up on Google are like a year old or 9 months old. So I just wondered if you knew any more about that. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I've heard rumors of the death of the IC7100 for probably better part of 5 years. But recently I read, I do not remember the source, but at the time it struck me as a legitimate one, that they had finally retired the ICOM 7100s. By the way, they also retired my Flex radio, the Flex 6700. So I think both of them have been retired legit. Whether or not ICOM is going to have something specifically in the same class, a relatively low price, not a lot of bells and whistles, all-in-one radio, they haven't told anyone about that. It might be in the pipeline for a year or two or three. Who knows? It might not be. You know, nowadays, software-defined radios are very popular, so, you know, they might just try to go with something like that with, a color screen interface and touch screen and a little on the fancy side and mark it up a couple of $100. But I don't know, but as far as I'm aware, yes, the 7100 has ceased to be produced. I think they still have a lot in the pipeline, so you can probably buy them, but eventually that will end, as all good things do.
Yeah, it looks like, and the prices, even for a used one, I see are prices that are a couple hundred, $150, $200 more than I paid for mine brand new. I think people are starting to jack the price because it's, you know, availability and all that kind of stuff. And I was hoping for a successor, and I saw this thing called the ICOM 905, but that's just a even fancier version of the 9700. It says all band, but turns out it's not HF. It's just the stuff that's higher than UHF. Like,
I guess even more than the 9700. So anyway, I hope they come out with one. But mine eventually goes. I don't have the space to be buying a second one now. And, you know, something that has not just all the bands, they don't have one that has all the bands at any price range, you know, including higher bands and HF. But something with a little head, I need that for my space. So it'd be nice if they had a successor to that. So if they just put the, what you said, the touch screen with the color, and they just put a couple hundred bucks more on it, that would be great. But we'll see. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I don't know what their future plans are. Thankfully, ICOM is pretty much dedicated to the amateur radio business, as opposed to, you're never quite sure what's going on with Kenwood. You know, one day that they care about amateur radio, the next day, not so much. So, you know, you can't really depend on a company like Kenwood, whereas Yaesu and ICOM seem to be consistent. They design new upgrades, and you know, the only problem is that the marketing department probably has more say than the engineers do. They try and figure out the price points and features and go with it. So, again, I would be surprised if they do not present us with something vaguely reminiscent of the 7100 in a somewhat different form factor and price point. I agree with you. I like radios with removable heads. I have my FDM 400 and my ICOM 7100 head sitting on my desk with the bodies to the left of me in a TV rack.
Yes, me too. And my setup is that I would be forced to put a radio, any other kind of radio. Every time I wanted to turn up the volume or down or change any touch of button, I'd have to, like, inconveniently kind of stretch forward. Yeah, it just wouldn't be nearly so nice. Plus, I pull this thing into my bedroom in my little apartment with the extra long cable. So, yeah, for me, that's great. Back to you. So I guess, yeah, if we can get on to the puzzle, if no one else has a question.
Okay. The TechNet puzzle tonight, a coax line is called unbalanced because, then you have four choices as an answer. Choice A is the two conductors are not at equal potential. Choice B is its impedance is lower than that of an open wire feeder. Choice C is it only functions at certain frequencies. And D, it has concentric wires. So the question once again is a coaxial cable line is called unbalanced because why? So anyone want to hazard a guess of why coax lines are considered unbalanced?
I suspect I don't really know, but I can hazard a guess.
Okay. Bob, do you want to hazard a guess?
I'll just say D. I know it has concentric wires, if I think it does. But I don't know if that's really the reason. I'll just do that as a guess. Choice D, concentric wires.
Okay. Coaxial cables are, by definition, concentric. They're coaxial, but it's not the shape of the conductors that determine whether a transmission line is balanced or unbalanced. So with that in mind, do you have a second suggested answer?
Then the two conductors are not at equal potential. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'll try that one. It seems to possibly make more sense to me than the other two.
Okay, very good. Yes, you are correct now. It's an unbalanced because the two conductors are not at equal potential. Balanced lines have equal and opposite, whereas unbalanced lines have a ground and a signal. So, you know, if you think about it, your coax line, you consider your shield to be at ground potential. You can... And the other signal is going through the center line. So whereas with You know, with computer Ethernet cables and such, there are winded peers, and they're both at equal and opposite potentials, and those are all balanced lines going through your Ethernet cable. Whereas in terms of coaxial cables, the shield again is ground potential and the other one is the signal potential. So that's not the same potential. So that's the difference between balanced versus unbalanced transmission lines.
So basically potential, tell me if I'm wrong, maybe they're fine, it sort of means the same thing as voltage, or is that only partially true or not true at all? I think it's at least partially true.
Well, the signal is voltage and current. Consider both or either. But again, a shielded a balanced transmission line does not have a ground. It's free floating. So if you have a twin lines like you had on your old television set had 300 ohm twin line, there is no ground. They're equal and opposite, so in both voltage and current going through them. So I hope that answers it to a degree.
What about something like in your audio stuff, like XLR cable? That's grounded, right? It's got three connectors. Does that mean it's unbalanced, or is it also balanced and grounded, or anyway, back to you on that one.
Yeah, it's both balanced, but it includes a ground. So each of the two balanced lines are operating at in the opposite direction, but it's referenced to the third wire, which is the ground potential. So it's a balanced line. XLRs are considered balanced lines. RCA cables are unbalanced lines for the same reason.
So I don't think that's really the reason. But the ones that look like there's a thing on the outside, a thing on the inside, they're not balanced. The balanced ones, they seem to have these parallel wires. And I guess an XLR has three parallel wires or two parallel wires with a, I don't know if the shield has, I don't know what it looks like on the inside. But I'm getting a little peripheral there, but that's a visual way to maybe identify them.
Well, if you're talking about XLRs, you can have XLRs in a series of different modes. You could have just two parallel lines. You could have twisted pairs. A lot of times you'll have twisted pairs, and there'll be shielding around the twisted pairs that are part of the ground system. So that's the usual wires that if you cut into an XLR, I think you'll see.
Okay, good. I get it. Yeah, I kind of get it now because the actual coax. Yeah, because it's just got one wire in the middle and then the ground. So I just have to get on down. Back to you, Roy. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any other questions or comments to make before we call it a night, please feel free. Hit that push to talk.
Hey, Roy. This is KG3VA Max. I have a question about coaxial cables. Why the 213 rather than the skinny one?
Okay. Let's see. Coaxial cables that we use are all hopefully 50 ohm impedance. They do not have characteristics otherwise that are equal. As you make your coaxial cable thinner and thinner, you tend to have a decrease in power handling capability. And also, you tend to have more attenuation loss, especially as it gets longer or as the frequency gets higher. So although RG58 is great coax cable, it's light, it's flexible, it's cheap, if you're going to put it in your car, that's fine. If you're going to feed a UHF radio to an antenna on your roof for 100 feet, it's abysmal. The amount of attenuation loss for something like RG58 is very high, especially UHF-VHF. So the reason why you see a lot of people using 213 or LMR 400 is so that when the transmission line finally reaches their antenna, they have limited the amount of attenuation loss. A simple 3 decibel of attenuation loss in 100 feet, which isn't that unusual, is 50% of your signal lost is thermal waste heat. So the lower the loss of your transmission line, usually the better. But if you go crazy, it would mean massively expensive transmission lines, big, heavy things, stiff things that are very difficult to maintain. So the happy medium, again, is something like the 213 or the LMR 400 for most hams. But if you're doing microwave, you got to be more persnickety than that. You want something even lower loss, solid shielding and such. But the bottom line is we like things, coaxes that are thicker because they tend to be built with less loss as you increase the length and increase the frequency being used for them.
Interesting. Would you consider the RG8 in the same category as RG58?
No, RG8 is vaguely similar to 213. It's not quite as low loss as LMR 400 or clones of LMR 400, but it's significantly better. If you just look at the measurement, RG8 is about 4/10 of an inch in diameter, whereas RG58 is a lot skinnier than that. I think it's 1/4 of an inch.
So if you're looking at RG8 versus RG213, I get the 213 is quite a bit thicker. Would you still have the same loss issues with RG8 versus RG213?
I think RG8213 and LMR400 are pretty much the same for 1/10 of an inch. The differences tend to be in the type of shielding. In the case of RG8, there's a single braided shielding. In the case of low loss LMR400, it's two layers. They take a tight weave copper braid and they cover it in a solid aluminum skin, so it's double shielded, which allows for a slightly improved loss figure than the RG8. RG8 probably is one of the oldest. The RG designation used to be a military grade because coaxial cables became a thing with hams once you were able to buy it after World War II in the Army surplus stores. They had miles and miles of the stuff, and the amount that they manufactured it lowered the underlying price, but then they were getting rid of it anyway. So that lowered the price even more. So all these RG designations are military spec designations, kind of bespeaking their old age, whereas LMR 400 came, decades after that time. And so it's just a MicroTimes brand designation for that type of coaxial cable. Very popular, copied all over the place. DX Engineering sells a version. Chinese sell all kinds of variations on that theme. It's very popular with hams and just generally as a transmission line.
That's interesting. I was just trying to figure it out. Funny enough, I don't really see LMR, but it's probably somewhere buried in one of the other categories here. But what's interesting is the RG8 is about half the price of the RG213 for the same length.
Well, yeah. Again, it's a matter, I guess, of quality. I don't know the particular design specifics between RG8 and 213, and also has a lot to do with the manufacturer. Anyone and their brother can manufacture an RG8 and an RG213 because LMR 400 is a brand name, not a military spec. No one else can use it specifically to sell their product. They can say in small print that it's similar to LMR 400, but they can't just designate it as an LMR 400 cable. So you're probably paying for a higher quality in manufacture. If you ever saw some of the garbage Radio Shack used to sell under standard RG designations, there was one I took a look at where the braid material was almost invisible. It was so loosely woven together that the isolation on a coax like that would be abysmal. But, you know, if you just bought a package of it, if you didn't have X-ray eyes, you wouldn't know the difference. You'd notice it when you tried it out. It would act rather screwy. So I don't think it's a jip. I tend to think it's just a difference between higher quality manufacturers and tighter specs. And also 213 is a somewhat less lossy type of design than the RG8. Probably for the coaxes that are 0.4 of an inch diameter, the most lossy would probably be something like the RG8.
Kings County Radio Club holds exam sessions every 2 months regularly. Please check kingscountyradioclub.com for more information.
Okay, back. There's an announcement going on. Yeah, I was looking, it's interesting to look at the prices because RG213 is about 125, 400 feet with Jetstream. RG8 is about $100 with Jetstream. And then G8X, which is, I think, the Mini 8, is about $70, 400 feet. So it's interesting how much of a difference that this makes. Obviously, you probably know why I'm asking, because I'm looking at cable for the IRZX connectivity to the roof. And I'm just wondering if we need, like, the full-on 213 for lossiness and quality, or can we get away with a Mini 8 cable? Would that do what we need to?
Well, you might be able to get away with it. You know, it's at least VHF instead of UHF, which is better for our circumstances. The problem is it sounded like we were going to need 100 feet of the stuff. And we were kind of dubious of whether or not the antenna that would not be too obvious would hit the repeater or not. So you probably want something with a reasonably low attenuation. So I would either stick to an RG8 or a 213 as opposed to an 8X or a 58, because that's going to, you know, I mean, the reason why you're paying so less for the 8X and for the 58 also is because there's less copper in it because it's smaller. So, you know, and copper is expensive. But, you know, if you were going, you know, if you were going 10 feet or 15 feet, I'd say, yeah, it doesn't make much of a difference. But if you're going to go for 100 feet and you're going to be possibly ending up using a compromised antenna, you probably want something with at least mediocre as opposed to a not terribly good attenuation loss.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, just get 100 feet of 213, even if it's going to be pretty much double the price.
In a word, yes. I mean, you might get away with the cheap stuff, but then you might not, and then, you know, you got to restring things, or else you got to rethink the antenna and install another antenna. So, you know, I tend to like to err on the side of not having to redo things. It's not the most cost-effective means, but I think under the circumstances, you know, 213, and 213 is not the most expensive coax cable either. You know, I mean, like I said, I have everything in my shack is LMR 400. which is more expensive than 213. I think 213 is a very good coax cable. I don't think it would be wise to use either 58 or 8X for this particular situation because of the compromises that we apparently are going to need to make.
Got it, hearing you loud and clear. During the field day, I'll go through the box again, and I think we have 25 and 50-foot cables. I got to see if maybe there's a 100-foot cable already hiding in our storage. Because if we don't, then we got to get another 100-foot cable. How do you feel about taking, let's say, 250-foot cables and stringing them together? Is that a big no-no, or is that okay?
It's okay. Some old timers will bend your ear about how UHF connectors are not 50 ohms and there's losses between connections. But if it's a good quality UHF connector, it's going to add maybe about a tenth or two tenths of a dB. Which, you know, I wouldn't worry about. The big thing to keep in mind, though, is to weatherproof the splice. You know, it's UHF connectors are not inherently waterproof, so you should weatherproof it in some way. You don't want water to get into the coax cable. But that's the only thing I would advise you. You could splice two of them together without any problem.
Perfect. Yeah, just thinking through doing this connection, we have some cables already in our storage thing that Mitch has. So just want to save the club another, you know, $125 purchase if we have what we need already. I'll check it out if we have maybe 250-foot cables, because there are quite a few in the box. Maybe we can do that. I'll check it out, see what it looks like. Because we do need a few for like field day operations and stuff, but I wonder if we have a little too much. Check it out. Should be interesting, and if not, when we'll have to order that. Meanwhile, I got the power supply. Works pretty well. I did a little bit of test on it. I sent you guys photos. Seems to be working. Seems to be producing the right amount of voltage. I did connected it up. We had it all start up. Was drawing no more than I think about 6-7 amps when I was testing it out. So looks like it's working, and the box is massive, but it seems to be doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Okay, very good. I assumed it was a linear power supply, right? It's not a switching power supply. You can kind of tell the difference by how heavy it is.
Oh, yeah. This was a used, I forgot the name of the brand. That's the one you recommended, but it's a 20-amp linear power supply. So all in with shipping and tax, it was like 110. So pretty damn good price, I'd say, for a 20-amp linear power supply.
Okay, that's good. That'll work fine. It's an Astron, a very very popular brand power supply manufacturers. They make all different kinds. They make linears. They make switching. They make metered. They make unmetered. It's a big business they're in.
Yeah, if by metered you mean has some kind of voltage display or amp display on the front panel or anything else. Yeah, there's nothing like that. Literally just an on-off switch with a light in it, so you know it's working. And on the back, there's a ground connector and just a plus, a positive and a negative terminal. I put a wire on it. The circle connectors, I forgot the name of them, by marine terminals. On one side, put some Anderson pole connectors on the other side, so I have it all up and ready to be running, and it seems to be working pretty well. We'll see. So I'm going to take a day, run it for 24 hours with the computer and everything on just to see how things go, just check a little bit of the power draw so we can answer that question. The incremental progress.
Okay, very good. I think it will work out for us. Yeah, metered power supplies have voltages and usually current indicators. You know, it's not necessary, and if you really need it and it doesn't have it, it's rather inexpensive to run in series a power voltage and current indicator. You know, Amazon sells them for $20-25 or such, but not really that necessary. You know, everyone should have a voltometer, just in case. it'll work out. It's a very sturdy design. They're built like tanks, so it should serve us for many, many years to come.
Comment, AC2ZV.
Yes, William. Well, what's your comment? Yes, William, what's your comment?
Hey, Roy, it's William on Echolink. Does it come through?
Yes, it's coming through on Echolink, William. Well, what I should say is it was coming in when you asked, is it coming in on Echolink? But probably the time before and the time after it didn't, because I didn't hear anything from you. So you seem to have some kind of intermittent connection somewhere.
Well, I'm back to the radio. So the question is it better to have a more efficient switching power supply or one of these heavy boat anchors in the long run?
It depends upon how cranky you are. If you go down to 75 meters, you will no doubt bump into a couple of guys who will curse as much as the FCC will allow them about switching power supplies and tell you fish stories of what happened to them 35, 55 years ago with the very first switching power supply ever designed. Modern-day switching power supplies, if you buy them from reputable manufacturers, are excellent products. They are lighter, they are more efficient, and just easier to deal with. All of my power supplies are switching power supplies. You know, if you want to play cranky, then you buy the more expensive, less efficient, heavier, bigger power supply that's linear power supplies. But I think that switching power supplies are great as long as you buy from a manufacturer that you know about. You know, there's more ways to get it wrong than a linear power supply. But if you buy from a reputable brand, chances are it will be just as effective at less money and requiring less power to feed it than would a linear power supply.
Things I'm wondering about is standby power. Like if I have the radio off and the power supply on, I'm sure it's sucking down juice for no reason.
Well, I mean, there's always going to be standby power requirements. There are regulation ships that are active and all kinds of things going on. If you have the power supply on, even if you're not supplying a load to it. But, you know, volt for volt, amp for amp, switching power supplies tend to be significantly more efficient than linear amplifiers. I had a small Woolwart linear, I keep calling them linear amplifiers, they're linear power supplies. I have a Woolwart power supply that I bought as a kind of experiment to see if it fixed something, and it was only about 60% efficient. So in other words, for every 10 watts of power that I fed it through the utility line, I could only get back 6 watts for the piece of equipment I was powering. So that's not a very efficient design, but that's what you get for a linear power supply. So there are energy losses for both type of power supplies, but you'll find more power loss using a linear power supply.
Like to me that if you have all the information you need, like how much this thing is using, the efficiency, et cetera, you can decide if it's plugged in 24/7, it's actually going to justify buying a switching power supply over leaving the linear power supply plugged in.
Well, yes. If your primary factor is cost of running it, then certainly it's less expensive to supply than a linear power supply. It's not like linear power supplies are cheap. They use these really larger iron core transformers because the energy transfer is less efficient at 60 cycle utility cycles. So, you know, it's kind of lose-lose. Linear power supplies tend to be a little bit more expensive simply because of the massive transformer. You know, when you factor in all the extra circuitry for switching, but then you downsize your transformer significantly, you usually end up with a slightly less expensive design. So, you know, most power supplies, linears cost more than switched, and to run them, linear certainly cost more than switched. But again, you got the cranky guys who say that, hey, it introduces noise to my signal. I don't want noise. Then they swallow the weight and inefficiency and cost factors. And if it makes them happy, so be it.
I always heard that the part of the argument was that there was large capacitors in the linear power supplies to smooth the thing out. And so because of those giant capacitors, is able to like provide like source load, like even if it's rated 20 amps, it could actually suck out 30 instantaneously and stuff like that. So your peak peak power was better with a linear than it was with a switching, because the switching would just clip at 20 amps and okay, you're done. Where a linear might give 30 amps if you cranked up the power and then when you talk for a short period of time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that strikes me as an attempt to make a bug a feature. In linear power supplies, you need higher capacitance to smooth the ripple because the frequency that you're smoothing is much lower. You know, if you have a full bridge rectifier, it's going at something like 120 cycles per second, whereas switching is 10,000 cycles a second, so you need a lower capacitance smoothing filter. It might marginally give you a benefit. Have you known anyone who actually complained that they had to swap out their switching power supply because of that problem? I never have.
Sounds like you might have heard these guys on 75 meters, but personally, I've never had that problem. But I worked for customers who required it, and they thought it was better, so we just delivered what was required.
Well, yeah, I mean, the customer is always right. So if the customer is used to something that he's been buying for 40 years, a lot of guys don't want to jump into something until it's perfected. I don't know, my father, may rest in peace, was waiting for them to perfect color television set. He passed away in 1973. I think color TV was at least 10 years old at that point. And I had to buy a color TV set for the house. The customer is always right. So if they want linear, so be it. But like I said, I have nothing but switching power supplies, and I haven't had any problem. I think you might have the Elinco with the adjustable clock speed. I have one of those, and I never needed to adjust the clock on it. So, you know, it's not a problem, or at least hasn't been a problem for me.
It comes down to the bottom line of the most cost-effective power supply is the cheapest one, and if you get it and it works, just keep on using it. But I would think over a few years it might end up using more power than it's worth, but it would be a long calculation. We'll have to see how that turns out.
Okay. I mean, I don't tend to believe in the cheapest thing is the best thing. It depends on the situation. If they're disposable and such, so be it. But in addition to the cost of buying it and the cost of running it, you got to factor in the cost of replacing it. So, you know, a little bit more complicated. And what happens if it goes bad? Is it a calamity or is it just a nuisance? So there's a lot of things that go into factoring in what's required and what's tolerated and what would be the best compromise.
Agree, and brings me back to my own phone company adage: if it works, don't fix it.
Yep. Words of wisdom.
Internet control. Thanks for that diversion, Roy.
You're welcome, William. Anytime. Thank you for your participation. Again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any other questions or comments to make before we call it a day, then please hit that push-to-talk button and say your piece.
I think, Roy, I got to correct you there a little bit. You would have to be calling it a night. It's almost 11 o'clock at night.
Well, yeah, it could be a night, but it also could be the 14th of June, which is a day. So, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
All right. I give you that one. But thank you for answering all my questions on this. I feel like we're getting close. I'm going to run it for 24 hours or so. I'm going to connect it, everything, and make sure it runs. Let's see what the draw is and just get an idea of what power, how much power it will eat, like in a day, in a month. Because I feel like it's going to be not very used kind of actively. But now that we're creating some affiliations, you know, this Columbia affiliation, there might be a couple of more. I think some folks might start using Echolink a little bit more. It would be good to have a couple of more things available to attract some of these other folks. We'll see.
Yes, indeed. We'll see. I don't know if we'll have quite a big WiresX presence present. You know, but the more the merrier. Give people options, and we'll see how things work out. You never know.
Well, one more thing that I'm actually trying to do right now is have a Raspberry Pi with a screen that has software, and I'm trying to remember what it's a PiStar, I think. Yeah, PiStar software on it. And supposedly I can create a bridge connectivity between my DMR radio, I have the Anytone, and the WiresX room. I just got to still play around with it and see if I can do that. If that's possible, then I could potentially enable the use of our room from far more devices than just Yaesu devices. Should be interesting.
Okay. You cannot directly connect a PiStar to WiresX. WiresX is a proprietary series of servers in Japan that is run by Yaesu, that Yaesu does not allow third-party networks to directly connect to. What you can do is you can act as a bridge between WiresX on your HRI 200 and feed it into another WiresX compatible network that isn't owned by Yaesu, but your PiStar itself, all the placed servers that it can connect to, none of them are directly WiresX. They're at best separate servers that individual people have fed the WiresX channel audio signal to in digital mode.
Ah, that is very interesting. Okay, so that idea might not be so good to work on. All right, just kind of starting to think of like how do we make it more accessible so more people can connect to that particular digital room through the internet, maybe not directly through using a radio, but through some kind of other mode of communication. Interesting. Let me do a little bit more research on that.
Yeah, sure. Although it's a crazy world. When we would thinking of doing that with our old WiresX room and building gateways, people tried to do it locally and failed. We finally found a guy down south who's a Linux maven, and he was able to get together all these little gateways. And when I asked him for the source material, he said there really wasn't any. He had trial and error, and he got little bits and pieces, but there's no place you could actually look up how do you connect WiresX to one of the many servers. You just have to discover it, you know, like a leprechaun's gold. But, you know, he used to be a member of the club for about a year. Then he kind of dropped away.
Okay, much more complicated than I thought. All right, well, just start with getting the WiresX room running through our repeater, so connectivity to that through our repeater, and see where we can go from there. Start small.
Yeah, yeah, that's a plan. So it shouldn't be a problem. You know, it's not really that difficult to accomplish. Again, different gateways are tricky things, but a straight line connection to the WireZX servers in Japan shouldn't be a problem.
Actually, Roy, quick follow-up on that. So when the FusionNet was running on Thursday night, and I was not able to hear it on the repeater, right, because I didn't have a radio, but I was able to connect to some kind of reflector through my PiStar. What was that? Like, how was I able to hear some of it? Although, funny enough, I could hear some but not all. There were some people that were completely silent to me and some other people I could actually hear.
Yes, that is the amazing gateways. I think the guy's name was Randy. Still is probably Randy. That's the gateway. There are multiple gateways. There are gateways that feed gateways that feed gateways. Occasionally, the gateway interfaces get corrupted, and so they go in one direction but not the other. And the more connections, the more things that can break. And so you were noticing what would happen eventually is there would be some people that could transmit but not receive. There were some people you could hear, but they couldn't hear you. It's problematic. And what the solution, unfortunately, is just to reboot the server and wait for the next time things screw up. But that's one of the many problems with multiple gateways, which is the method that you used. If you go to the website that they have, they'll have instructions on how to utilize more than a few gateways. This guy Randy really busied himself with putting together, cobbling together all kinds of interconnects.
What is this, Narnia? We have to like go through the secret wardrobe and to get somewhere? Is that what's going on here?
In a word, yep. I mean, be thankful there are no lions involved.
Got it. All right. So basically that's what I was using. All right. Complicated, but interesting. Start small. Go somewhere else after that. All right. Well, thank you so much for answering that. Always something new for me. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. That's what we're here for. And thanks for participating tonight. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Technical Net. If anyone has any further comments, questions, or what have you, before we call it an end, then please hit that push to talk. Otherwise, the next voice you hear will be me saying goodbye to yous. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be July 5th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. And we now have the Columbia University is using our repeater on Monday nights at 9 p.m., so listen to them. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. You just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscounty.com. kcradioclub.com, or you can also use www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank for their generosity. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So we're going to roll this all up and put it away, and we'll be back June 28th. You're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. Next time that we meet here, it'll be after field day, so I wish everyone a happy and successful field day. This is AC2GS, and I'll be clear and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, be well, and we'll talk down the line. This is AC2GS clear.
Thank you, Roy. Good night. G2VEA, clear.